Welcome to The Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, over the weekend at Elite 11, you broke a story that, from what you told me, you were under the assumption had already been broken.
Yeah, so the background on this is Malik Zaire, the former Notre Dame starting quarterback, albeit briefly, graduate transfer, had been on the market for a while. And last, a week and a half ago or so, I had reported that Zaire was expected to transfer to UF if the SEC had amended its graduate transfer policy. Well, on Friday, 3 days ago as we're taping, they did that. And in the wake of it, Malik Zaire had tweeted maybe an hour after the news got out, "Let's go!" with exclamation point. So that was kind of cryptic, but I think it, you know, I assumed it meant, as a lot of people did, that he's heading to Gainesville. So when I'm out at the Elite 11 on Saturday night, it was the second day of the camp, and there's other media there, but it was the second day of the camp, and I saw Malik, and I know him a little bit. I've, you know, covered him and been around him, you know, basically for the past few years. We started talking, and at one point he told me, "Yeah, I'm heading to Gainesville on Wednesday. It's actually going to be the first time he's ever visited UF, but he's excited to play it at Florida. And he thinks it's, you know, he loves the challenge of it being in the SEC," which he kind of compared it to the major leagues, "and he's going to embrace that." So, and then we talked a little more. He told me he was going to be, you know, I said, what are you going to study there? He said journalism. He thinks that he wants to maybe even write as part of his graduate degree.
Did you try to talk him out of that?
I said, there's been a lot of layoffs in the business, Malik. You know, you may want to stay and look on the on-air side, because he's a pretty dynamic kid. He's a good speaker and very, very outgoing and ebullient is the way I would describe him. So maybe the TV side's a little more makes more sense given the state
of
our industry.
When's the last time, if there has been this, I can't recall, that a college football player, like a notable college football player, after finishing college, maybe after finishing the NFL, became a sports writer?
I got one, because he's a friend of mine who I work with at ESPN Magazine, Alan Grant.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Alan Grant once led the nation in punt returns for Stanford and played in the NFL for 4 or 5 years. And he did... He worked at ESPN Magazine as an NFL writer and actually liked to write other stuff more rather than NFL. But he definitely helped our rec league basketball team, because even at like 35, you have an NFL cornerback and a kick returner, he's still going to be probably the best athlete on the court. But anyway, back to Malik. So after we talked, I kind of walked back to some other guys I knew and just tweeted out, spoke to Malik Zaire, told me he's plans to head to Florida on Wednesday and very excited about the challenge playing the SEC. And then subsequently posted something on my Facebook page. And within 5 minutes of me posting, I kind of glanced back at Twitter because I saw my at mentions were blowing up. I think it got retweeted over 100 times. And the two guys I was with, one's in the media, one's not, said, "Did you just break this story?" I'm like, I kind of thought it was already broken, but there was no real, like, Malik hadn't really commented specifically on it till we talked.
He didn't send out an actual, like, "I am committing to Florida" tweet.
He did not. And what surprised me a little bit was it was his second day there, and there is some other media there and some other reporters. So I wasn't sure if anybody had talked to him on Friday. I was tied up with some family stuff on Saturday earlier in the day. And I figured somebody had talked to him, but, you know, and then I, you know, thought about it more. And I was like, you know, most of the guys who cover this are recruiting reporters, and they're really primarily focused and locked in on what they're seeing from the guys who are, you know, at this point, rising high school seniors, not a grad transfer. And certainly one, you know, I guess there was somebody who covered UF there who subsequently talked to him later for 247 later that night. But interesting story. We'll see how it goes. I mean, you know, Malik's talented, but remember, he's thrown less than 100 career passes. I think 6 touchdowns, 0 picks. He's going in late. It's not like he's had spring football to get acclimated. Felipe Franks has a big, strong arm, but he's never really played. They liked what they saw from him in the spring. I'm curious to see how it's going to work out. The two biggest question marks I have, and this is from what I've heard from people, you know, who've been around Malik, is just how consistent can he be, and also how quickly can he pick up a new system, you know, because he's going to have to hit the ground running there.
So I'm with you. I'm, you know, I do think this has a potential to be one of those really big grad transfers that has a big effect on the season. But it is crazy to me that Malik Zaire has generated this much hype. When else would you see a guy, a grad transfer that everybody would get this excited about, who's basically played in four games, you know, in any sort of significant role? Now, he looked good in that bowl game against LSU, certainly in that season opener 2 years ago when they clobbered Texas. He was off to a good – well, they were about to lose to Virginia when he got hurt.
He was struggling in that game, and then DeShone Kizer came
in
and rallied.
But think about back to that time. He was so well thought of already that when he got hurt, everybody thought, well, Notre Dame season's down the drain, and didn't realize, obviously, that DeShone Kizer could step in and do what he did. And then to start last season, Brian Kelly, and he took a lot of criticism for this, basically had them on equal footing, that they were going to just both play against Texas. I was actually there for their media day, and his explanation was, you know, these are two of the best players on the team. We got to try to find a way to get them both on the field. So there is a lot of reason for Florida fans to be excited, especially given the just awful run of quarterbacks they've had there post Tim Tebow, with the one exception of that one half season with Will Greer. So there's reason to be excited. But I would also think you'd want to temper those expectations a little bit because of all the things you said. It's just not realistic to me. He's not going to be Russell Wilson. Could he come in and be a solid starter, a good dual threat player who helps them be more productive on offense than they have been, though? Absolutely.
If I say to you, because I feel like we've seen all over the map. We've seen Russell Wilson, who was even better than he was at NC State, he was terrific. He was really productive at NC State in 3 years as a starter. We saw Vernon Adams, who came in and was like just lit up the sky when he was on the field. Now he was banged up and everything. Danny O'Brien was the opposite end of the spectrum. He was like all ACC freshman, and then he went to Wisconsin and was kind of never heard from again. Your guy, Jeremiah Masoli, who had a lot of success at Oregon, did not really thrive at Ole Miss. It's tough to say.
More recently, Davis Webb.
Davis Webb had a good run. Davis Webb actually had a really good run for Cal on a bad team. I mean, I think he won them probably as bad as they were last year. I think they would have been, you know, maybe a 2-10 team without him.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think he can do this? Everett Golson, who Zaire was, you know, supplanted eventually at one point, grad transfer to Florida State 2 years ago, got hurt at one point, but played 9 games, 67% completions, 1,778 yards, 11 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. Do you think he can do that?
Statistically, I think Everett was better than he felt like he was on the field.
Yeah.
Here's where they're really opposite personalities. I mean, Everett Golson is, I would describe him, especially for a quarterback, he came across as being a little bit aloof, whereas Malik Zaire is a light up the room kind of guy. And I think if you're a graduate transfer to come into a new situation, I think that's a good thing. So I think that gives him a better chance. But like, look, Everett Golson actually played in a national title game. It didn't go well, but he played a lot more than what Malik did. I mean, Malik's basically spent the last 5 months in Arizona training with a private QB coach, Dennis Guile. And we'll see, you know, like I guess on Friday, I didn't see how he struggled there in some of the passing drills. And on Saturday, when I saw him, he looked very good, you know, and that's the question with him is consistency, because as you said, it's not just been the quarterback play. Florida's offense really for much of the last 7 or 8 years has been just absolutely dreadful.
And yet they've been to back-to-back SEC championship games. So if you're a Florida fan, you're thinking, if this guy is good, if we were able to get there with no offense, this guy's good, and then, you know, they've got some other pieces now, if they can get the offense cranking, not a 50-point game offense by any means. Just get cranking a little bit more, and the defense, well, there's a lot of pieces to replace on defense. I don't know if they'll be as dominant defensively as they have been the last couple of years, but, you know, you start to basically, let me ask you this. We both have talked about how Georgia is the favorite in the SEC East. Does this Zaire news change that for you? Does it make you revisit who you think could win the SEC East?
No. I need to see more from their offense before I believe anything from it. I mean, here's why I like Georgia, because they have two terrific running backs. They have the best group of running backs on that side of the division. But really, when I look at it, I mean, which quarterback do you have the most confidence in that division? Jake Bentley from South Carolina? I mean, who are you buying in?
Jake Bentley had a really solid, promising freshman campaign. I think he'll be really good. The question is, do you think Jacob Eason takes the next step, becomes the superstar quarterback that was billed to be coming out of high school?
I'm not ready to put all the chips on Jacob Eason. I'm going to hold back on that.
Well, you know, the SEC East just continues to be not very impressive. Speaking of the SEC East, Destin last week.
Well, wait, before we get that's quite a segue. I like that.
It was quite a segue, now I'm going to go back on it and realize that I should first ask you any good tidbits from the high school quarterbacks you saw at Elite 11.
Yeah, a few. I'm glad we did circle back to this. This was the biggest group physically by far that I can remember, and I've covered this thing for 15 plus years. I mean, there was a lot of big dudes who were 6'4", 6'5", 6'6". You know, some guys were up to 230 pounds. They look like grown men. I mean, a lot of them really did. They were saying they thought this was as good a group as they've had since the Dilfer group's been running it, which is like 5 or 6 years. I didn't spend as much time. I was there Saturday and Sunday, but I was not in every session like I was, you know, a few years ago. The guys who jumped out, Trevor Lawrence, there's two great quarterbacks or two terrific prospects from Georgia who kind of headlined this group. Trevor Lawrence, long-haired kid who's like 6'6", you know, 210 pounds, committed to Clemson, grew up as a Tennessee fan, is locked in all Clemson. He'll get there early. He was as advertised. The other one is Justin Fields, who's committed to Penn State. He's about 6'3", 225, terrific athlete. He is good at everything. I mean, he's smart. He's athletic. He's dynamic. People love his work ethic. He loves James Franklin, but he told me he's getting a lot of pressure from Auburn and Georgia and Florida State and UNC. So those two top guys are big time guys. And there was another kid from LA, Tanner McKee, who's 6'6", 220, look really good. And then there was a few guys I'd never heard. Like, I didn't know anything about Devin Leary, who was a kid from the Northeast who's headed to NC State. He's not very big, but if I was an NC State fan, I'd be very excited about him. He showed a big arm. There's another one that Gus Bradley's son, I didn't know he was anything about him, but he's from Jacksonville. Was every time I was like, who's that? And then I realized it was that kid. He threw it really good, and he's like a under the radar guy. So I thought it was a really, really strong group, one of the better groups I can remember, you know, in 15 years, and certainly the biggest group.
Is there anybody there who's not committed?
Yeah, there's a few kids who weren't. There's a kid from Phoenix, and I want to say his name is pronounced Shu or Show, Tyler Show, who's a really lanky kid. He did very well. I think there's a handful of kids who either aren't committed or they're still, you know, they're committed, but you could see a battle. Carter Bradley, that's Gus Bradley's son. He is the kid from Jacksonville. He's open, and I think there's going to be an interesting battle. You know, from what I heard, Toledo was a big in the picture, maybe Wisconsin, but I would imagine you'll see a lot more traffic on that kid. He was really accurate. He's, you know, I hate to compare him to like a Jake Browning, but that's kind of because Jake Browning obviously was not a camp guy. He was a great high school quarterback, but in terms of accuracy, in terms of anticipation, he did that. He's not huge physically, but I really like what I saw. He's one that I think you'll hear a lot more of.
I know obviously every school gets excited about their hotshot quarterback recruit, but I got to think Utah fans have the most reason to be excited just because they haven't had a big time quarterback there since
Alex Brian Smith. Johnson.
No, you keep saying Alex Smith, you keep forgetting about Brian Johnson.
Are we going
to let them do an undefeated season?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know if in retrospect, maybe this is not fair, but I don't know if I think of Brian Johnson as a big time guy.
Not a big time guy. Certainly wasn't the number one pick in the NFL draft. But, you know, just the last few, I mean, Travis Wilson, his last year was pretty good, but it took a long time to get there. they're winning. They've been, you know, Utah's been successful the last few years, but they've been successful in spite of their passing game, not because of it. So it's a lot of onus to put on a guy. As you know, half these Elite 11 guys don't end up even starting at their original school, much less becoming a star. They'll end up, half of them will end up transferring. But I think that's reason for them to be excited. Are you ready for me to circle back to the SEC?
Well, let me fin in. We didn't really mention this kid's name. Jack Tuttle is the kid we were referencing. He's from the San Diego area. He's about 6'4". One big thing, which I think bodes well for him, is one of the guys who doesn't really work directly with the Elite 11, but is around it as he's part of the virtual reality group's driver that has you know, now in with a lot of college programs. Trent Edwards, former NFL quarterback, played at Stanford. And Trent and I had a long talk, and we talked about Jack and how the kind of questions he asked, the kind of how focused he was. Usually guys who you hear people talk about the way he talked about Jack, those guys don't turn out to be busts. Now, I'm not saying Jack Tuttle is going to turn out to be Matt Ryan, but I'd be surprised if Jack Tuttle does not turn out to be a very productive college quarterback because of just the way they talked about his focus, maturity, all those other things. So anyway, now I think, yes, now I'm ready. Oh, one other thing for Michigan fans. It'll be very interesting to see how Joe Milton works out for the Wolverines with Jim Harbaugh. He's a kid from Orlando. He is very big, 6'4", 235. He has the cannon for an arm cliche. He throws it through a wall. I mean, he does look like he throws a very heavy ball at times, but we'll see what happens. I mean, he's an intriguing prospect. Like I said, big arm. Is just, you know, can he make all the throws in terms of, can he take a lot off it? Does he throw a touch? Those things. But there's quite a piece of clay Jim Harbaugh is going to have coming in next year.
You know, it used to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but it used to be that if a program got one of these five-star type quarterbacks in a class, they would then not recruit a quarterback in the next class, you know, knowing they don't want to create a logjam. But now, because these kids transfer so much, they just get one every single class if they can. And so I'm saying this because Michigan just signed Dylan McCaffrey. He's coming in this year. He's considered to be a big-time quarterback. Now you're going to have another one the next year. As we know, they are not going to both be there for 4 or 5 years.
No, and best example of it is a lot of people thought Hunter Johnson was the top quarterback in the 2017 signing class. And here comes Trevor Lawrence, who right now is considered the number one overall recruit by a lot of people. He's a quarterback, and he's heading to Clemson. And when we talked on Sunday, I said, you know, I brought that up and said, you know, didn't bother you at all? He goes, no, wherever I go, I know I got to compete, and I'm going to have to try to beat somebody out for that job. And so, I mean, this kid was not fazed at all in the way he presented. You know, like there was no fluctuation, you know, anything. You know, at one point we talked about him growing up a Tennessee fan, and he was like, no, I'm on board everything about Clemson. It's the coaches. It's where it's at. It's the kind of success they're having. You know, he just, like, there was no hesitation or anything. And I think sometimes that's the attitude you need to have. And the kids who were kind of scared off a little bit about it, maybe that's not the kid you want quarterback on your team anyway.
Well, so as you may remember, I did a story about this in around signing day this year, mm-hmm. about just how high a rate the quarterbacks transfer at now. It's 50%. And yes, that's a big part of it. They all feel like they are going to beat out whoever. But I just also think they now know that there's always a plan B. So if it doesn't work out, if you don't beat the guy out, you just transfer to the next school. So whereas maybe a generation ago there was a stigma attached to that, now it's just, you just know that that's possibly the way it's going to go. And I don't think they go in thinking, oh, I'm not going to beat him out. They think, of course, I'm going to beat him out. But if they don't, it's not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, and the challenge, too, is sometimes when it's a guy who's not the starter yet, I mean, right now, don't worry about Dylan McCaffrey. He's not going to be the starting quarterback. The job is going to be open at some point when you have Wilton Speight there. The question is, you know, like, there's a reason why I think UCLA had a hard time getting a quarterback till this year after Josh Rosen. It's when you have that freshman starter who's probably going to be the guy for the next 2 years, then maybe the next class is harder. I think it's harder when that kid is the freshman starter and he's going to be there for a while, as opposed to, hey, you just signed the number one guy, but he's in the pipeline. I think there's a distinction there I would make.
And yet at Georgia, you know, Jacob Eason was the savior. He was committed there for 2 years. Everybody knew he was going. Everyone knew he would probably start as a true freshman. And yet the next four or five star, Jake Fromm, comes in this year. And already you saw the stories this spring. Could he beat out Jacob Eason? Didn't dissuade him.
No, it didn't. And who knows? Maybe he knows something that other people don't. We'll see how it how that one unfolds over the next 2 years.
Okay, SEC. So SEC meetings wrapped up last week. I don't know if like people. So SEC meetings wrapped up last week in Destin, and I don't know if like SEC media, just because of the thirst for content there, have to come up with a new storyline every year. But they made a much was made this week about should they switch up the divisions. In particular, should Auburn move to the East? And it wasn't just out of nowhere. Their own AD and coach are kind of pushing for it now. It is not on the agenda. There is no, you know, movement whatsoever for divisional realignment in the SEC, but it hasn't stopped people from taking it and running with it. And I had to do a triple take when I saw a column that came out Monday morning from a longtime reporter columnist in Tennessee, John Adams, saying it's unfair that Tennessee has to play Alabama every year. And basically, if Auburn is going to move to the East, then Tennessee should, I don't know, they should end these cross-division annual rivalry games. Tennessee shouldn't have to play Alabama every year. Their rival.
Do you think this is a case, knowing the media as you do and the cycle, do you think this is a case of, you know, people need something to write or something to talk about on their radio show?
Possibly. Well, very much so, yeah. I mean, I don't know John. I don't know if he wrote that just for that purpose or not. He may genuinely believe that it's unfair, but one thing about college football is people sometimes think that we get into a state, so right now Alabama is what it is, and people get into the mistake of thinking this is how it's always going to be. And do you know that before Nick Saban got there, now that was a decade ago at this point, but in the 12 seasons before Nick Saban took over at Alabama, Tennessee won 10 of the 12 meetings. Tennessee owned that rivalry at one point when Fulmer really had it rolling. I don't know, was it unfair then that Alabama had to play Tennessee every year?
No, and I mean, look, life's unfair. I'm so, you know, that attitude, I think, is you kind of shrug your shoulders at it. I mean, Tennessee should not be, and I don't think Tennessee is complaining. I mean, when you have the media complaining, it's maybe a different story, but
This also plays in with the idea that the divisions are unbalanced, and certainly the West has been a lot stronger than the East for probably since Alabama got this thing rolling. But again, that wasn't always the case. I remember long stretches of time when Florida-Tennessee was the premier rivalry in the SEC and Georgia was pretty good and the West was the afterthought. This stuff all moves in cycles. Nick Saban will retire at some point and it'll move back over to the East. That's just the way this stuff works.
Yeah, so let's get back to the thing that, you know, really, you know, get back to this point with Jay Jacobs, the Auburn AD, and the discussion about Auburn shifting conference, shifting divisions. Two things that jump out at me, and I had this conversation with our colleague Joel Klatt the other day a little bit about this, which is now with the Big 12 going to basically just a lump of teams as opposed to two divisions, and they're still going to have a conference title game. If you are another conference, would you think, okay, this model might be more interesting for us because it probably gives us a better chance of a tougher title game matchup? And, you know, you don't have that risk of, we could have the team that's number four in the country versus the team that's number 22 in the country. If you have, and typically we see this in bad divisions. There's one good division, there's one lesser division.
Yeah, but I'm of the opinion, and we'll have to see how it plays out, that the Big 12 is making a mistake by doing it this way for that very reason. This is you're increasing the chance of your national best playoff contender getting knocked off in the championship game because they're definitely going to be playing the second best team. You've totally eliminated the possibility of putting two teams in the playoff. I think you're better off doing it the way the SEC does. Once in a while, you get there was a period there where you had a bunch of basically BCS championship play-in games, two between Florida, Alabama, one between Alabama and Georgia in 2012. Now, since then, it's been pretty lopsided. But, and for whatever reason, it's always worked out for the SEC. I can't remember, there was one time when they had a team that would have played in the national championship that got knocked off. It was way back in 2001, Tennessee lost to Saban's LSU team. But other than that, it hasn't really worked against them. Whereas in the Big 12, when they still had a championship game, they had many occasions where the team that was BCS championship bound lost. So I don't know. If I'm all these other conferences, I would sit back and wait and see how it works out for the Big 12 before I would consider changing to that model. I also just think that in the SEC, more so than the other conferences, there's a lot of, I mean, people are just pretty invested in those divisional races. It means a lot to win the SEC East, even if you're not, you know, even though Florida has gotten, you know, spanked by Alabama the last couple years, there's still a lot of pride among those Florida fans that they beat out Tennessee and they beat out Georgia and they won the East Division.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, look, I do think there is some of that that goes on where, you know, it's like with the bowls, people from these teams want to say, hey, they want to hang up the division, you know, banner somewhere in their facility. We were the Big Ten West champs, or we were the this or that. And, you know, if you have one division, that takes away from that.
Right. So my hunch at this point is that they don't, the divisions don't go away. I mean, many people have made very solid arguments why you should get rid of them. It certainly is making scheduling, I will say this, it's making scheduling a lot harder when they're at 14 teams. It would probably be a lot easier if they didn't have divisions and you could change out almost entirely from year to year which teams they played. I mean, right now, in these 14-team divisions with an 8-game schedule, you go 7 years without facing some of the teams in the other division. You go 12 years without playing the other team's stadium. That's nuts. You're just like, you're not even in the same conference.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you're predicting, you think this goes anywhere 5 years from now?
Which part of it?
That people rethink the division models?
I think everybody will watch the Big 12 model. And if it looks like it's made the Big 12 championship game more interesting and it hasn't really, it's helped not hurt their playoff chances, then yes, I could see others copying it. And then if it works the other way, they won't. And the Big 12 will do the divisions. As stupid as the idea of having 2 5-team divisions would seem, I remember writing who should be in the divisions. And because right now, you know, they're tinkering with it. They moved Bedlam up to early November to avoid them possibly playing. But you don't know. I mean, we don't know if those are going to be the two teams. It could be two teams that are playing Thanksgiving weekend end up playing again the next week. That's the other danger if you don't have divisions.
Agreed. Agreed.
Speaking of the Big 12, so the narrative, certainly on this podcast in many places for much of the last year or two, has been what a dysfunctional mess that conference is, and with expansion, with on the field, with recruiting. And then, of course, that leads to the obvious, well, is the Big 12 in trouble? The next, you know, is Oklahoma and Texas, are they going to bail the next time it comes up? So the Big 12 had their meetings last week. Doesn't get quite as much coverage as Destin, but nonetheless, I think people don't realize how well the Big 12 teams are doing financially under the current model. They are doing very well.
Well, didn't we talk a little bit about this a year ago with George Schroeder about, I don't want to call it the hidden money, but some of the deals, obviously, that people know about the Longhorn Network, they don't necessarily think about Oklahoma and their, you know, side deals or some of these other places where there is more money, right? And I think that because of the volatility and some of the outspokenness from especially both Oklahoma schools, I think you get kind of a feeling of uncertainty and instability, which is, look, I think some of that's real, but I think that adds to this, right?
I think the instability has largely been created by one person, David Boren, and his kind of like, when he speaks and shifting of the winds, it makes it seem like a really messed up conference. There have been other things as well. David Boren spoke again after these meetings, and now he is very much, no one is significantly stronger than we are in any of the Power Five conferences. We can hold our own with any of them in regard to our financial picture. Boren said the Sooners, despite the assertion of some outside the league, aren't desperately seeking to find another conference, or is any other school. Emphatically not, said Boren. You can tell that from my own conversations, we're more optimistic than we've been in some time about the future of the Big 12 and the strength and stability of the conference. So the money is the revenue distribution that went out this past week was $34.8 million per school, up $4.4 million from last year. Now, these TV deals, the way they're structured, it's always going to go up at least a little bit every year. You don't get the same amount every year. It's structured to go up with each passing year. And then the numbers that you see reported are the average. The per team average has nearly quadrupled over the years. Schools shared $106 million a decade ago, about $8.8 million per team. Couple factors, the championship game coming back adds some revenue as well. Now, I think what you're referring to, that conversation we had with Schroeder, and this is an important thing to note, when you see the Big Ten or the SEC revenue distribution numbers, that's the whole thing. There, that's every sort, every TV tier, every postseason stream, that's all it. The Big 12 schools still have their own tier 3 rights, most notably the Longhorn Network. Oklahoma also has its own network, I believe, that airs in the state. So $34.8 million is the baseline. There are schools that are making well more than that. And once you get up to that, you definitely are talking about Big Ten, SEC-type money. As it is, $34.8 million is a pretty nice – there's a pretty nice gap now between them and what the Pac-12 and the ACC schools are getting. So I wouldn't be running to write the obits of the Big 12 just yet. This financial model, at the very least, is working for them.
You know, you mentioned the ACC. People who cover the sport, and certainly a lot of fans of it you see on social media, will rip the passion of the Conference of Champions quite a bit. But when it comes to the ACC, certainly, you know, you have a couple of national title teams in the last few years, certainly with Clemson and FSU. I think people forget maybe that they're, you know, I don't know if they forget, but it's interesting. They kind of get a pass on sometimes, I feel like, of where they are in this discussion. You know, people kind of dump on the Big 12. I think some of it comes from the, you know, the low draft number, right, that they've had in the last few years. The issues with defense certainly add to it. And I think it kind of all bundles into this, right? And with the exception of Austin, you don't have a lot of big market towns in Big 12 cities. They're all pretty small. I mean, Lubbock's decent size, but the rest of them are not very big either.
By the way, real quick, just to put it in perspective, Clemson got the biggest revenue share of the ACC teams this past year at $27.9 million.
That's a huge drop compared to the Big 12.
It is. It's a pretty sizable gap. I think most people thought that the Big 12 – ACC and Pac-12 were about the same, but they're not.
Not even
Big 12's definitely doing better. And I don't totally understand why. I mean, that TV deal was made quite a little while ago at this point. But, you know, give Bob Bowlesby credit. He's worked this thing. And also, you know, there's something to be said for splitting the pie less ways. And that's another big reason why they haven't expanded. They like that they only have to split it 10 ways instead of 12 or 14. The ACC, of course, is banking a lot on the ACC network, which hasn't even launched yet. Here's a comparison of the five conferences. SEC's distribution for fiscal 2016 ranged from 39 to 42 million per team. Big Ten, 34.8 million. That's going to go up considerably once this new deal kicks in this year. So this Big 12 number is now outdated. You heard what it was before. And Pac-12's was the lowest at $28.7 million per school. And the Pac-12's is not going up by a lot because that network isn't doing well. So I'm sorry, I've forgotten. What was your question?
My question was just about the perception of the ACC because, you know, we hear a lot of belly aching about the Pac-12 as a brand and as the passion of it. You just don't hear that with the ACC. And as you alluded to, with the ACC network coming in, but the ACC network's coming in at an interesting time because of, you know, ESPN's fingerprints on it and the uncertainty around ESPN, but just some of the issues that company is dealing with in the wake of layoffs and cord cutting as it's kind of impacting their business model.
Yeah, I think it's nuts. I don't, for the life of me, understand how you can launch a linear cable channel from scratch around a conference that is extremely passionate about basketball, but basketball is not football. You have some extremely passionate football schools, Florida State, Clemson, Virginia Tech, Louisville. And that's about it. You also have a whole bunch of schools that, you know, are not going to draw a lot of eyeballs TV-wise. So at the time, I think it's almost been a year since that was announced. At the time, I talked to some people who thought, you know, it's going to be okay because either ESPN's either going to just launch on one of their existing channels like ESPNU, or ESPN has, you know, contracts that expire with Time Warner or Verizon, you know, and you need a Charter, whoever, and they can just throw this in with the other channels when they're negotiating their new deal. But I don't know, the whole thing, the whole ACC network thing puzzles me. But to the ACC's credit, the reason you don't hear the whatever criticisms about them that you do the Big 12, the ACC is as stable as it gets. They have now signed over their grant of rights, I believe, at 2036. So these teams are going to be there for another 20 years. Notre Dame hovers over it. Our guy Tim Brando always stirring up the masses with his with his theory that they're going to join for football at any moment. That always hovers as a possibility, and just being associated with them helps them out a lot. So they're in great shape, even if the per share or whatever isn't quite up to the others right now. They're in great shape. The Pac-12, you hear a lot of grumbling because the network hasn't done well, I mean, plain and simple. They also just don't have – it's just the way it is. It's, they're never going to have anywhere near the level of kind of rabid interest in their product that there is for the certainly the SEC and also the Big Ten. And then in the Big 12, again, money, financially, they are fine. But they still have some very real competitive issues that we've talked about many times. I mean, those recruiting numbers are alarming. The draft numbers are alarming. Obviously, they were clearly fifth out of five last year on the field. Now, both you and I are bullish on the Big 12 coming, on the Big 12's prospects for 2017. But they've got some real serious issues that need to be addressed. And I and maybe you just can throw this money towards something other than lockers. But, you know.
I think, I do think, from everything I'd heard, certainly this weekend, I think Tom Herman's recruiting will alleviate a little of that if Texas is the flagship school in that league, which it's supposed to be, along with certainly Oklahoma. I think that puts some polish on it, and that would change it.
By the way, I definitely think that the whole perception of the Big 12, not the whole, a big part of the perception of the Big 12 being mediocre,
hinges on Texas.
Of course, wouldn't it be just the Big 12's luck if Tom Herman gets it rolling in Texas, they're contending for national titles, and Bob Stoops retires at Oklahoma and they fall into muck.
Yeah, if Bob Stoops retires, I would imagine that, you know, Lincoln Riley will step in and they will, I don't know if they'll be, if they can do everything Bob Stoops did with, you know, all the titles, but I think they will, I think they have some, I think they have some resources there that'll bode well for them.
I think Bob Stoops goes completely underappreciated, and I think maybe won't be fully appreciated until the day he retires. And by the way, he's been buying our property in Chicago. I don't know why, but, you know, that leads to conspiracy theories about it. But my gosh, you really, I don't know, whoever it is, Lincoln Riley, Chip Kelly, whoever you want to name, good luck replicating one, two. We will count, we will, we're just, somebody tell me how many conference titles he's won.
I don't know, like 15. I mean, it's, I don't want to say he might be like 10 for 17 or so.
Somebody try replicating, starting with the year 2000, 13-0, 11-2, 12-2, 12-2, 12-1, 8-4, 11-3, 11-3, 12-2, 8-5, 12-2, 10-3, 10-3, 11-2, 8-5, 11-2, 11-2. And there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 conference titles in 17 seasons. It's one of the all-time great runs. He gets criticized sometimes because they haven't won the whole thing since 2000. They've played for it a few times. They made the playoff 2 years ago. They haven't won the whole thing. It's not like Saban, who's racking up rings. I get it. But that is still a remarkable run. There's no way the next person will come close to that.
Is he on your ever-shifting top coaching top 20? Is he in your top five? I got a segue coming, Stu.
I guess I got to revisit that list. I can't remember where he was last year, but after these past two seasons, he definitely belongs very, very high up.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I'm tinkering on where does Dabo go? Where does Jim Harbaugh go? I mean, I think he's in there with Jimbo Fisher. I would put him in the top six of that group. You know what he's done. Now, as we do this, here's our segue. One of the guys that I always say you are too light on, who's worked wonders in Manhattan, Kansas, was in the news a lot last week.
He sure Bill was, Snyder. For all the wrong reasons.
All the wrong reasons. So, for starters, the coach can almost never will win for how he handles blocking the schools that a kid wants to a player wants to transfer to. In my mind, the only valid the only valid thing you could block is if the school itself has filed some kind of complaint or turned in somebody for tampering. And if that's the case, then I could say, okay, then, you know, that's a school you can block. Some of these other ones, especially when you don't even play the team. I mean, I remember a few years ago, Derek Dooley wanted to block some receiver that they had from a MAC school. And it was like, well, we theoretically could play them in a bowl game. I'm like, I'm not even sure that matchup is possible unless there was like, you know, everybody went 5-7 around them, you know. But that's the pettiness you see with coaches. And Bill Snyder not only went there, he went beyond there on camera. And I think that's what led the change into the policy there this week.
So it is, you wonder like what kind of bubble the coaches live in where they think this is going to be accepted, that you can block kids from mass number of schools. But this Bill Snyder thing was extreme. As it was reported, he just flat out, and as he confirmed, it wasn't that he was blocking him from certain schools, it was that he was blocking him from transferring entirely. And his explanation, as he was explaining it to, where was that, at a function or something?
Some kind of function. Yeah. I don't know exactly what it was.
As he was explaining it, I'm thinking, has he never let a kid transfer in his entire career? Because that's what he's making it seem like. He's saying, you know, everybody wants to be the starter, but not everybody can be the starter. And if you let all
your
number
two, this is a guy who's taken as many transfers as anybody.
Yeah. So of course, you know, we're gonna try everything possible to keep that from happening. But hey, you know, if he wants, he can still transfer. We're just not, he's just gonna have to walk on. Like, you know, you want to go play somewhere else? Sure, go walk on. It was so bizarre and so, I mean, he took a lot of criticism and rightfully so, but I was almost like, something's not right here. As we know, Bill Snyder is getting up there. He's 77 and he's been dealing with a very serious health issue this year. It was frankly a little sad. He just seemed like, I mean, oh, and we're leaving out the most important detail. He outed this kid for having failed multiple drug tests, which you can't do. So, I don't know. That was the first moment where I was like, you know, I think when these coaches are kind of legendary figures like he is, there's a certain deference where you say,
this comes back to what we talked about a couple of weeks ago and how it usually doesn't end well for coaches.
It really doesn't. They don't know when to call it. You know, he tried retiring. It didn't suit him. The program went south for a few years. He came back. At the time, he indicated it was going to be a short-term thing. He's still going. And, you know, the stories this year were like, you know, he's getting cancer treatments, but he's still showing up for work every day as if that was something to be proud of. I don't know. This was the moment where I thought, uh-oh, this could be heading toward a very ugly ending.
Yeah, and look, it was the first big test for the new AD came from North Dakota State. And, you know, from talking to some people around the K-State program, you know, John Curry, who's now the Tennessee AD, I think probably didn't get enough credit. There was some, you know, for how well he may have buffered that dynamic, which is very awkward. You know, it's no secret Bill Snyder would love his son, Sean, the special teams coordinator, to be the head coach there. You know, you sometimes wonder, you know, how well are they thinking out some of, you know, clearly in that case, that was not well thought out or is very tone deaf, as you said. And yeah, it's going to be a very interesting dynamic. The AD jumped in there. Bill Snyder issued an apology through a statement, you know, to the player. But those are things you do not win on the public platform, especially as social media is now in 2017. I think when you're in Manhattan, Kansas, you probably can get away with some of it because there's less of a spotlight there than certainly if he was in the SEC or in Columbus, Ohio, or certainly, you know, at a lot of other more high profile programs. But
outed the kid's drug tests, he was painted. He was back in. He couldn't have possibly tried to block him at that point. I mean, I don't know how that, I mean, could the kid have sued? I mean, they basically violated his
right. Anybody can sue. The question is like, where would the case have gone? You know, the question is how it relates to HIPAA. And a lot of times coaches hide behind that HIPAA for other things. In the case of this, it seemed pretty damning to do it, especially on camera. It wasn't even like a he said, she said kind of thing.
Right. I think that we both think he's one of the all-time great coaches. And so it's one of these things where you feel like you have to tread carefully. But I do think the end is now nearer than maybe we would have thought. And you're right. It's this political showdown that is coming, whether because his name is on the stadium, because he is that program, does he just basically get to say, I want my son to be the coach and he's the coach? Or will this new AD truly say, I'm going to hire whoever I think the best person for the job is?
My hunch is, and I felt differently, a month or so ago when we had this conversation, you know, I thought, hey, it's Bill Snyder. He deserves the right, you know, you name the field after him to give his son a chance, even if it's, you know, for whatever. I think that because this became so public and was so awkward, and they had to walk it back, I think this probably diminishes the chances that Sean will be the successor. I don't know if it diminishes it, you know, entirely, but I do think to some degree, I think it hurts the chances going forward where the AD had to say, okay, I don't know what kind of thought process we're getting here, but if this is an example of it.
Wow. So you think
a little skittish.
If the AD was having, and we don't know, I mean, he's still pretty new. We don't know what he was thinking yet in terms of a succession plan.
Look, for all we
but
know,
you think
AD
this is the out
there.
He may have needed?
I don't know. I think it's possible because there is definitely some pushback on that. Look, for all we know, the AD who obviously was the one who hired Craig Bohl may say, "Hey, Craig, I like what you're doing at Wyoming. You want to come coach in the Big 12 someday?" You know, where he's familiar with that part of the country. But I don't know. That was a thought that came to my mind as, you know, like within 24 hours after this thing blew up the way it did.
So, long before Jerry Sandusky became what it became, I mean, years before that, it was clear to many people that Joe Paterno should go. He was constantly battling health issues. He was coaching in the press box by the end. I remember being around him at Big Ten Media Day 2010, so a full year before he would end up being fired. And it was like, wow, like, when it happens very abruptly. Because up before that, it was always like, well, he's 78, he's 79, but he doesn't seem like it. He's got the energy of a 62-year-old. And right. Then all of a sudden, it was like, nope, he is his age now. It always happens so quickly, and then they don't get out when they should. Bobby Bowden as well. I mean, the last decade of his time there was a mess. Bill Snyder, we think his team could be very good this year. On the field, it hasn't really... There has been no sign yet that you know, things are slipping away. But this was definitely a bit of a wake-up call moment.
Well, his staff certainly knows what he wants. I think in terms of that regard, they do a very good job working together. I mean, I've done a few of their games as a sideline reporter, and they all seem to be on the same page and know what he wants. So, to me, that part where it's a little different, whereas at FSU, as I recall, with Bobby Bowden, you had a changing dynamic on the staff. You know, some guys got hired away from FSU, and just the roles changed and the staff chemistry got bad at FSU. Whereas at K-State, I don't think it's that way, at least to my knowledge. From what I heard, it's not. So that's one of the reasons why I think they were able to do things like the way they, you know, physically took it to what seems like a more talented team in Texas A&M, certainly in the bowl game, and why you think they're a top 15 team this year.
Well, you know what the common thread was with both of those and with this was loyalty to a son. You know, Florida State's offense under Jeff Bowden just got worse and worse, and he just kept hanging on to him until he finally couldn't do it any longer, and that's when they brought in Jimbo Fisher. Obviously, Jay Paterno remained Penn State's at least co-offensive coordinator and certainly quarterback coach right up until the end. So, I don't know. I mean, Sean, to this point, is, from what it's been described, he's a special teams coordinator, but he's also, like, I don't know, how would you describe it? Chief of staff?
Yeah, he's almost like an assistant head coach in that role, too. From talking to guys in the Big 12, a lot of other coaches like Sean Snyder, and they think he does a really good job on special teams. So... But again, and look, we've seen guys who are special teams coordinators become head coaches. John Harbaugh is one, Tony Levine, Brian Polian. It's not that uncommon. So, but again, new AD, And like you're saying, top 15 caliber team, going to be a really, really interesting 2017 in Manhattan, Kansas.
While John Curry, the former AD, is walking into his own kind of messy situation at Tennessee and a possible coaching change if they struggle this year, I would say he got out of Manhattan at the right time.
I would agree with you 100%.
All right. I think that's all for this edition, right?
Yes. Then we're going to do a mailbag. Send your good questions in.
Bruce, do you know what the email address is?
Audible@audible.com.
Seriously, I've been reading this every week for 3 years. You don't know the email address.
No.
No wonder we don't get that many. We get a good number of emails. We don't get that many emails because the co-host doesn't even know the email address. This is going to be an outtake. We need to make a big deal out of this. It is theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Again, theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Send your questions. We'll be answering them later this week. And as always, if you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get podcasts. Tell 10 of your friends while you're at it. We'll see you next time.